All right, welcome everybody to the AMP211 podcast. My name is Brett Rower, CEO and founder at Amplify and Elevate Innovation, joined by my amazing co-host, Rebecca Boltzma. We are here today with Jeremy Shore, a man who needs no introduction, and yet we're going to do it anyway. Jeremy, welcome to today's AMP211 podcast.
Thanks, Brett.
Jeremy, I know everything about you because I'm fortunate that I've had the chance to work alongside you. But for those at home listening around the world, could you let everyone know, in your own words, who is Jeremy Shore and what is the amazing work you're leading in AI, education, and innovation?
Sure. I refer to myself as a dancing monkey a lot because that's a big part of what I do. I like those situations, Brett, where people say, Jeremy, go do this dumb thing or figure out this problem and solve it. Those are my favorites. But I was a public education for 16 years in two different districts in Ohio. For the past 9 years, I've been doing consulting in the emerging technology STEM space, mostly for an organization called TIES and the STEM ecosystems. And that work is around STEM school design and engineering, design thinking, blended learning, computational thinking in CS. And as you might imagine, just like everybody else, these days seems to be about 95% to 100% AI, helping schools think about both how they should be implementing AI systems to improve their own work and how they're preparing students for a future that is pretty dramatically impacted by AI and AI technologies.
That was very well done. You always start with the dancing monkey thing, but then you really bury the lead of how much incredible work you're leading across the country and especially there in Ohio. For folks that don't know, could you just expand a little bit more about, when you talk about like TIES and these ecosystems you're leading, what does that look like? How are you supporting schools and districts and organizations worldwide?
Yeah. Here's what I can tell you, Brett, is that when I was in a school district, my second school district, I was lucky enough to be a part of some work that got a bunch of national press. And we had, you know, Wall Street Journal out, New York Times, and, you know, all these countries and blah, blah, blah. And when that happens, those of you in schools who've been in that situation, you know that the consulting companies start coming to, you know, try to poach people. And I said no for a long time. The reason why I eventually jumped is because TIES, which again is where I do the bulk of my work, has a little bit different philosophy around consulting. And the STEM ecosystems follow that same principle. And their principle is that it's ludicrous for some guy in Ohio to have any idea what you need in New York or Canada, in your rural school, in your inner city school, in anything that's not my direct experience. So TIES philosophy is that, number one, we come in, we do a lot of listening, a lot of talking, a lot of research around what the specific problems and strengths are in a region. And then we use all of the partners that we've met globally to sort of create solutions. We don't have a solution that we hand you. And I at least would have a really hard time working for an organization that did, because I've been the guy hiring. I've been the guy hiring these consulting groups, and I've seen those products, and they're great, and they're research-based, but they're not always actually practical to implement in a situation, depending on, you know, money and time and availability and staff and all of these things. The STEM ecosystems were born out of TIES. STEM ecosystems were sort of and I get in trouble for saying this, but kind of an answer to the question of, you know, what is STEM and why has it sort of failed its original promise? A long time ago, when STEM was sort of first developed as a concept, there was a lot of talk around how it was going to improve workforce pipelines and economies and all of these outcomes, and we didn't really see that. So the STEM ecosystems were born as a way to address that, and the concept is relatively simple. Ecosystems are designed and run totally independently. Their geography is decided by the people who create them, as well as their focus areas, but they do have to be bringing together seven pretty disparate groups: K-12 education, higher education, business and industry, funders and foundations, out of school time, state, local, federal government, and Youth Voice. It's the only organization that I know that brings all of those folks together, and their job is to kind of determine what the STEM, education, workforce development needs are in a region, and then more importantly, to figure out what those verticals can do in combination that individual verticals have no possibility of actually accomplishing.
Well said, Jeremy. Great job there.
I've said it a couple of times here and there, Brett.
We saved the best for this podcast, and I appreciate that. All right, just to dig in a little more, because you mentioned all the amazing work you do. I love the fact that you said, you know, first of all, on Jeremy's LinkedIn, I think it still says some guy from Ohio, but you actually have traveled, you know, literally around the world in support of education and bringing the work you lead to, sometimes marginalized communities. You mind sharing a little bit, like, I know you work with Indigitize. What are some of the really unique places that you are, in conjunction with the organizations you serve, really bringing innovation to areas that typically aren't associated with that, here in the United States and beyond? We'd just love to hear what's going on in the world that most people wouldn't know about, but you're right on the front lines.
There's a couple things. So the first is a story that I tell a lot, and it's not a recent story. It's from about 7 years ago and still incredibly applicable. But I was lucky enough to keynote and work with some schools in Beijing at this sort of Chinese innovation conference. And the story that I tell a lot is that one of the other keynotes at this event was, and I don't remember his title, but essentially the Minister of Education for China. And his green room, I had my little green room that was like a dingy closet, and then he had this sort of beautiful green room across the hall with these two enormous, military guys standing out front. And I could see him, in there. And at some point, those two guys walked away. I don't know why, like coffee break. I'm not sure why. And being the obnoxious American that I am, I just sort of walked into that room. In very short order, I was physically lifted and taken out of the room and almost the country. But for a minute, I had the opportunity to talk to the minister. And I said, and I'm paraphrasing, but I said, why are you doing this? You, meaning China, are always crushing us, meaning America, on things like test scores and things of that nature. Why are you doing this conference sort of focused on innovation? And what he said to me scared the crap out of me then, still does now. And I think it's sort of an important thing, because what he said to me was, you Americans are never going to beat us in test scores. We have fewer standards. We have sort of cultural norms around success. We have, single languages. There are all sorts of reasons why you're never going to broadly beat us in test scores. But right now, we need you. The ideas come out of America, and then we can make them cheaper, more efficient. We have distribution networks, but we rely on you for the initial ideas. But if we can crack that, then we don't need you anymore. And that's been sort of the major rallying cry in my work, even pre-AI, for a very long time, is, our core competencies in sort of the core standards and core subject areas, really critical? Absolutely. I'm not diminishing them. But I think that our focus on them has taken away from our ability as a country to see a problem, to find a problem, to realize that the thing could be fixed or improved, and then to have the skills to fix or improve it. Instead, we're losing our drive on innovation when other countries are really kind of picking up the mantle there. And that's really been my driver. It's my driver even more so now that we're in the AI space.
Such a good, interesting segue into some of the things I want to talk about, especially since, the release of DeepSeek and some of those things that we're starting to see catch up, and kind of pivoting a little bit to generative AI specifically. This is just sheer personal curiosity because we were talking in the pre-show about your stack there of your great headphones and your podcast mic. I'm wondering what's in your generative AI stack right now, that your go-to tools that you're using all the time.
I think my guess is I'm similar to the two of you and a lot of people on our space, which is I don't have one because it's changing constantly. I don't expect the teachers, the schools that I work with, to touch and use every single tool they can possibly find because they don't have the time for that. They don't have maybe the interest level at that level. So it's my job and your job and everyone in this space to really be kind of changing and moving around and trying everything. I'll tell you that I do end up using probably ChatGPT more than anything else, not because it's necessarily the best at anything, but because it's, in my mind, sort of the best of everything. It's the best single package. So it's what I use with teachers more than anything else. Been using Notebook LM a lot lately, particularly when talking about large data sets or kind of specific unique situations with schools that we can talk about if you want to later. I'm really crazy high on Sesame.com's voice models. If anybody listening hasn't played around with them yet, they have two voice models, Miles and Maya. Miles is the best AI voice model I have ever heard in my life. It is the first time I think that we are out of the uncanny valley to the level that I've put Miles on a phone call with, I don't know, 12, 15 friends and colleagues, and not one of them, except for somebody who'd used it the day before, not any other person realize they weren't talking to a real person even after about 10 minutes of conversation. I'm really kind of high on that model too, but I think that the big thing is the constant shifting of what we're trying. And to me, the real skill set that everybody needs to be thinking about isn't any of the tools. Rather, it's what are the problems that you're facing on a regular basis in your life that might be solvable or shiftable or made easier through the use of an AI tool. So anything to do with language, with conversation, with information. And then finding a tool that does that pretty well is relatively easy.
I'm often not speechless on here. That was very, very thorough. And I really want you to push a little more on. I'm agreeing with you in the fact that like certain tools like a ChatGPT are very like utilitarian, right? They can help you do a lot of things really well. But as you said, there's these nuance, like one of ones that might be like perfect at this one thing and then kind of not so useful in others. Would love to hear, you know, your perspective on, are there tools out there that do one of two things? And so you can take this question however you like. One is, what's some tools out there that are actually opening up people's minds about how school could be reimagined or redesigned? So big picture, like what's a tool? You're like, wow, that's incredible. Or what are some really unique one-off tools where you're like, you want to do something really cool with AI? This will be the best way to do that one thing. So I'll let you take it whatever direction you want, because you're going to go whatever direction you want anyway.
Yeah, I'm actually going to go in a totally different direction than either of those because, but related, still related. It'll dovetail in there somewhere. The reason why I'm going to slightly push back on your pushback is I really think that the phase that we're in right now, both the phase of the evolution of AI, but also AI more specifically than any other technology that's come around, should and needs to be, particularly in schools, a problem-first situation. That's a big part of how we address things like ethical and moral implications. It's a big part of how we actually make tools really useful. And I'll give you a quick example. I mentioned earlier that I was lucky enough to have some work that got a lot of press years ago. That work was in the blended learning space back when that was, you know, the hot thing, whatever that was, 15 years ago. And the push back in that time was, you know, everything should be blended. Everything should be digital and human, you know, and I sort of had a big problem with that because, you know, lecture became a dirty word. Well, the Feynman lectures are still some of the most beautiful pieces of learning that have ever been created. And I know of teachers who are still doing a lecture that like leaves kids crying and that they remember forever. So instead, what I used to say to teachers is, if you've got something you love, like don't touch it. It's good. What I want you to do is come up with two lists. List number one is, you know, what are the parts of your job? What are the concepts? What are the standards that you just don't like teaching, that you're bored with, that you're tired of? The other is, what are the things, whether you like them or not, that your students struggle with? What learning concept do they not always master even after going through your content? And ideally, I want you to find something that's on both of those lists. And that's what I want you to work to create a new solution for. That's where we're starting. So I carry this forward in the AI space. And my recent example with this is I was working with an administrative team in a district. I had a particular administrator, a special ed director, who was just really hesitant on using AI tools in general and just didn't want to bother with it. So I said to her, you know, what are these lists for you? What is it that you don't like doing or that's constantly a problem? And the thing that she came up with is she said, you know, I spend about an hour or two every single day, 5 days a week, so 5 to 10 hours a week, answering a variation of this email. I have a student with accommodations A, B, and C. I have created intervention X. Does this intervention meet the spirit and the letter of policy and law for these accommodations? So I use Notebook LM, and we put in there, you know, all of the state's revised code, all of the title laws that govern special ed, just a bunch of high quality documents and purchased books, not illegally downloaded books, purchased books that on the topic, you know, of creating interventions. We put all of the district policies in there, and we created a tool so that it's a teacher could say, I have created accommodations A, or I assume accommodations A, B, and C have created intervention X. Does this meet this? And it would spit out and say, yes, it does because of this, or no, it doesn't because of this. The way Notebook is structured, Notebook LM is structured, it links everything back to source materials. So they were able to see, okay, this is the portion of revised code that doesn't allow this as an intervention. Or this is a really great intervention because it meets all of these best practices. And I talked to that special ed director probably 3 or 4 weeks ago. And she said, you know, already that those, it's gone from 5 to 10 hours of those emails a week to 2 or 3 hours of those emails a week. That's, I think, the key is what is it that stinks in your life? If we do this right, and I don't necessarily think we will, but if we do this right, we are hopefully going to enter, you know, the greatest age of teaching in the modern era, where all of the administrative nonsense that teachers have to do on a regular basis is offloaded, and instead they can spend all of their time working with students, building relationships, and actually making a human difference.
I love that. And that's the ideal. But I also share your skepticism for us doing it right. As somebody who kind of lives in the what if it all goes wrong space, I like thinking about what if it all goes right. So in your mind, what does that look like specifically? Like, what do we have to do as individuals at an organization level, at a sector level, at a government level to make sure it all goes right? And where do you think we're going to fall short? Not to be the doom and gloom, just curious on your thoughts.
I think we'll be in one of two futures in 10 years. And I think that fork is happening right, that we aren't, you're not seeing as a fork yet, but that fork is happening right now. In 10 years, I think that people will point back to 2024 to 2026 as where the pathway started. And I think it could be really bad with pretty massive job displacement and no fix for that, with wealth inequality that makes current wealth inequality look like nothing at all. I think that the good future is a future, you know, it's Star Trek, not the outer space part. It's the part where people, you know, work in the areas they want to work. There isn't really poverty. And I think that future, I think AI is the enabling technology that could allow for that future. The problem is, you know, and you kind of alluded to this, number one, I don't know that I think that governments, state, federal, local, international laws, regulations have the power to shift it. This is a highly decentralized, you know, piece of technology. And I'm not sure if something is banned, it is still going to be very easy to use. So I don't think they've got the ability. I don't think corporations in general, there's some great corporations doing really great work, but broadly, I don't think corporations have the incentive to push us towards that future. I think that the only group of people that can push us towards that good future are educators, formal and informal, K-12 and higher ed, but educators. It's librarians, it's teachers, it's out of school time professionals. Where I'm nervous, Rebecca, is I can't tell you how many chief financial officers have said to me in the last year some variation of, if we're going to move a bunch of this administrative work off of teachers, why wouldn't we just have fewer teachers or pay them less? And that's not the answer. The way we get to that good future is by having school leaders who are understanding of the idea that the point of school is relationships and human connections, and that's how we make a difference, and that's how we change outcomes, and that we should use these technologies as enablers. I think we do that through conversations around ethics, learning around the biases inherent in these technologies, and working not just with teachers, but with administrators and with state and federal policy leaders in the education space, so that people know and understand the real potential for long-term value in this shift. But it's going to be a hard road. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't like to be a cynic, Rebecca, but like, if I had to guess, I think we're more likely to end up in the crummy future.
So I just read something in the last couple of weeks called AI 2027. Highly recommend you check it out. It was written by, actually, I think Brett was the one who put it first on my radar. It's from a former OpenAI researcher and a team who specializes in forecasting and foresight in the AI space. And what they predict, just like you said, two distinct futures of where we'll be in 2027. And I think you'll find that very interesting. But as a quick follow-up, if you had to list like 3 or 4 really important questions that we should be asking, or that educators should be asking to help guide our future down that path we want to go down, what are the most important questions we should be asking?
There's two that come to mind. The first is something that I think a lot of us in the education space have been saying for years, but now more important than ever. It's, you know, what's the source? What's the source? What's the source? Constantly. It's a skill that students have always needed, but they really, really need it now. You know, we all remember the Pope in the puffer jacket picture from a year ago. And like a day later, you know, people zoomed in and saw like his hand was all wonky. But like, you know, I'm sure all of you and everybody's constantly saying right now, that was the worst the technology will ever be. It's always the worst the technology will ever be. So we're not going to be able to zoom in and find a wonky hand. We have to constantly be asking what the sources are, both when we're using the technologies, you know, as has been often discussed, one of the main pools of training data for a lot of these models is Reddit and Twitter. And while I love both of, while I used to love Reddit, that just became a much more complex answer than I meant it to be. You know, there's a lot of crazy things on there. So what's the source? What's the source? What's the source? The other one comes from this really, really cool experience that I had recently. So I was working with a leadership team at Catholic school, an all-girls Catholic school. And, you know, when I work with leadership teams, there are things that often happen. I'm sure you all see this too. Like there's always this point where somebody says something about like, should this technology even exist? There's a lot of negative things. Should it even exist? Right. And so I've got the process that I normally lead people through where we, you know, we honor those feelings and we talk about them. And I share that, you know, if I had a way to snap my fingers and make AI go away, I think I probably would, believe it or not, make it go away. And then we sort of journey out of that into, but there is no magic. So what are we going to do to drive us towards a good future? But before I could do this, a nun, a 50-year teacher, 70-year nun, stood up and said, "You're all wrong. You are all wrong with all of these worries. I'm not saying your worries aren't real, but that's not the main point. The main point is that we can get back to the business of teaching these girls how to be great humans. If we can move away all of these other things, that can be what school is. School can be, how are we teaching people how to solve problems and be good citizens and good people?" That's, I think, it was maybe the most exciting. She's like, there's a picture of her now going like this in like two of my keynotes, because it was such a powerful moment to me. You know, here's this 70-year nun who saw it instantly that if we go the good route, we can be in this really, really amazing place where people are really learning how to interact with each other and how to be great people.
I want to meet that nun. That sounds like a fun combo. She sounds like a good hang. Jeremy, you also have some children in your own life. Is that accurate at home here?
I do. 15, 13, and then we have a COVID decision who's 3.
Okay. So those, I mean, especially between your olders and your youngest, big gap in terms of like what they're even going to experience, right? Because your younger child is basically born into the world of AI, or your other children had some time before and after generative AI at their fingertips. You're talking about raising good citizens, good humans, and AI can help do that. What are some ways you're using that even in your own household and your daily life to help your own, you know, your own children navigate this world and to hopefully be, you know, better humans as a result of some of the touch points you're giving them around AI and technology?
You know, the same types of conversations we had before AI about morality, about ethics, about the biases that are inherent in a lot of technologies. So we talk about these things with our kids, and we don't discourage them from using something like, you know, ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini. In fact, we encourage them to use them. But we do always talk about, you know, anytime you use a technology like this, you need to make it very clear that you are, number one. And number two, that there's a difference between using these tools to support learning and to support, you know, the creation of content, whether that's a paper or, you know, or something else, rather than writing it for them. And, you know, that's how I use it in my own life, right? Like I do a decent amount of writing. I'm a good writer. I can write like 5 or 10 great pages in 45 minutes. But first I stare at a blinking cursor for 20 hours. That's where I've used, you know, this technology a lot, is to shrink that 20 hours to an hour to be my brainstorming partner. But then I write. I use it the most, though. You know, my kids are in the freshman year of high school and in seventh grade, the older two. And, you know, there's a lot of content that they're learning that I learned this stuff, but I don't remember. And so I can use the tools, and I actually developed GPT for my brother that does this as well. So my brother's a firefighter, Really great guy. Was not an education-focused person. His oldest is in eighth grade and is squarely at a point where the stuff that he's learning is not stuff my brother can directly help with. So we made a GPT that has, you know, the strategic plan and the pacing guides and all of those things for that school district. It has all of Ohio's standards. It has some guides and some books on best practices on inquiry-based education, and then some instruction around using inquiry-based education, but sort of invisibly to somebody who's not a teacher. So my brother can use his GPT and he can take a picture of my nephew's homework, and it will say to him, you know, it doesn't give him the answer. It gives him questions to ask to slowly lead my nephew through being able to solve the homework himself. That came out of a similar issue here in our house. My middle daughter's very, very A-type, and she gets her homework done ahead of time and all of those things. But she came home a couple of years ago. This is like early GPT-3.5, you know, maybe early 2023, somewhere in that neighborhood. And she, you know, had forgot that she had a paper due the next day. And it was comparing Hatchet and the Hunger Games and the experiences of the protagonists in each. Well, I read Hunger Games, it had been 10 years. I read Hatchet, but it had been 30 years. I didn't remember these things. But I was able to say, you know, here's what the paper is. I don't want you to write this for me, but give me some questions that I can ask. My daughter's panicking right now. She read this stuff, but she's not thinking straight because she's in a tizzy. And so it said, okay, well, first, ask her what tools each of the protagonists had access to. Now ask them how they use those tools. And so it stepped me through this process that allowed me to help her with her homework, do it herself, do it in a humanistic way, but the tool amplified my ability to kind of ask questions and to help her through that. My youngest daughter really just got me in trouble because she told my wife, I love talking to daddy's friend that's a girl every time we go on a drive. She's so funny and she wants to know everything about me. And daddy talks to her all drive, every single time we drive anywhere. Because I use ChatGPT to sort of think through my day and to plan for outlay. So I got in a tiny bit of trouble. And now she has to refer to it as ChatGPT so that I don't get in trouble.
Well, you raised some interesting points, especially about using AI as a tool for learning. And obviously, probably we're teaching our children how to use it responsibly and the proper way. But I'm curious about your thoughts on the future of education and writing and essays specifically, because that's something I hear over and over again, that a lot of people, particularly in post-secondary, are worried about that because the essay has been an assessment metric for a century at least, right? So I'm just curious as to how you see that evolving and changing, or us adapting or needing to adapt, and your thoughts on the AI detectors.
Yeah. So, well, the AI detectors are both wrong all the time, probably immoral because they're based on student work and very, very easy to trick. So those are silly and whatever. I think this goes back to, you know, something we said when we started with one-to-one programs and Google became heavy in schools, which is, you know, teachers saying, some teachers, and I'm very clear to say that when I say things like this, number one, I think we're talking about a minority of educators. And number two, I think even the educators who say these things, they're overwhelmingly, their hearts are in the right place and they're asking the questions and pushing back for the right reasons, even if I disagree with them. I think it's all about what's best for kids, and that has to be sort of, we have to remind ourselves of that sometimes. But what, you know, we used to say a lot is, well, they'd say, well, students are just going to Google the answers. And then we would say, well, if they can Google the answer, it's probably not a great question. Do I think that we should eliminate writing? I don't. But do I think we should very seriously ask ourselves that question and answer it in a very real way? I do. I think that in every single subject area, we're at this inflection point that's going to be terrifying and difficult, but also exciting, because a lot of us in education have been talking about changing the way that education works and how it looks for a long time. And it's a really, really difficult thing to change an entrenched system. And I think these technologies are very possibly going to force our hands into a world where we have no choice but to change what education looks like. And that's terrifying, but also really exciting. My gut is that we still need to teach writing and we still need to have essays. But if you ask me to defend that, I have a hard time doing it. So I'm not positive that my gut is right. I want it to be right, but that's not what we don't base decisions, hopefully, on what we want to be right, but we base them on, you know, what is right. What I suspect will happen is the same thing that happened with calculators. It's the same pushback about calculators. It's going to ruin everything. Nobody's going to know how to do math. And what's actually happened is we've been teaching more and more advanced math at younger and younger ages. You know, in my kids' district, seventh grade is the normal time you take Algebra 1 now for most kids. That wasn't the case when I was in school. It was eighth grade if you tested into it, and almost everybody else did it as a freshman. They do it in seventh grade now, and it's not an issue. And that's been the result of calculator technology. And I hope that that's what happens, is that instead, you know, what I want to see is a world where it's less about, you know, can you write an essay? But if it's an essay, it's more about, can you write an essay that gets published? Can you write an essay that changes people's minds? Can you create something that will solve a problem in the world or just your community? And that's the school and the world that I want my kids to be in.
This is something I think about a lot because my background is in professional communications. And kind of my wish and my hope is that we see a little bit more of a return to a more oral culture, and people can articulate their thoughts clearly and explain their understanding. We know it's coming directly from someone's brain. And I think that we overcorrected so far to texting and emails that I'd really love to see a return to that more Socratic, engaging human-to-human dialogue as a core part of education. Just my two cents, though.
Yeah. That's my LinkedIn says Socratic consulting, which is like a nonsense word, but it's but I'm with you.
You know, Jeremy, you just brought up you brought up a lot of things, but I really liked what you just said, and I wonder if we could maybe collectively, after you give your insights, talk about this thing you just said, which is want to believe something because it's like how you've maybe been raised in your own values around AI and especially around like essay writing, as you said. I feel like that really crystallizes how I feel most educators feel right now. Like they believe what they've been, how they've taught or how they were taught, even if they know there's room for improvement, there's just something intrinsically like right about it. And there's this future that's really uncertain. So you're not really sure what you can say is quote unquote right to do instead of or in lieu of, and you're kind of in this limbo. Sometimes I've been sharing with people like this idea that like if the scale of learning AI is 0 to 100, like AI literacy, 0 to 1 seems to be the hardest part. And then like 1 to 100 is a lifetime. But like getting people to just kind of believe both parts are true, what you just said. I think this is right. I don't know what's next, but like it is here. And like I need to figure this out. And part of my journey is accepting both truths. How are you grappling with it? You kind of shared a little bit, but like what are you seeing? Or like who's doing this right to like get people's mind shifts better accommodated for this, or just kind of your thoughts on a bigger picture about like how you're helping people through that?
Brett, I think you're doing this right. I think there are people doing this right. And I do think that you're one of them. I think a lot of it, and I think it's difficult to fully understand this if you haven't been a school leader in sort of and I hate using the word innovative, but like in an innovative setting where you're trying to do something brand new. When there's teacher pushback, you know, back to blended learning, right? When I'd have teachers who were like, I don't want anything to do with this, and they'd really push back, what I'd eventually get out of them is basically that what I was saying was, this is a new way to do this, and the data's there. It is more effective when we use these different modalities. What they're hearing is the way I've been doing, you're saying that the way I've been doing things for the last 15 years was harmful to kids. And that's been the pushback. And that's why I think in all of this work in AI, more than anything else that I've ever faced, it's so incredibly important to honor and work through the fears, because the fears are warranted. You know, when somebody says in a session, should this stuff even exist? I think it might ruin the world. Like that's a warranted fear. It's a fear that I have. And there's definitely very plausible futures where it's true. We have to work through that. And I, you know, back to something I said earlier, I really think that the entree is almost always what do you hate about your job, and or what do you, are you finding not as effective with kids? You can even push off and blame the kids and say, maybe it used to be great. Maybe kids used to get it. But kids these days just are struggling with what is it that kids these days are struggling with, and work through those things. You know, you sort of turn fear and negativity on its head and make the fear and negativity the driver towards learning and experimentation. I also always say to teachers that, you know, that I'm lucky enough, if I'm working in a school, to be in a position where I get to speak to the superintendent and the principals directly and without worrying about any kind of negative, you know, lashback or whatever else. And so one of the things that we talk about is, what is it that you're afraid of from an administrative standpoint on this pathway? And then I get to be in a position to go address that with the principals and be, you know, maybe a little bit of the bad guy with administration. But teachers have to feel understood. They have to feel heard. They have to feel supported. People, I'm saying teachers, anybody, all people need to feel heard and supported and understood if we want to move them. So I think it's those two things. It's hearing them, and it's finding what they don't love and driving towards that. I don't want to touch things you love. It, you know, you have lessons you absolutely love, and they're, you know, paper and pencil, and your kids like it too, and it's effective. Don't touch that. You don't need to AI infuse everything. That's ludicrous. It's ludicrous. But where can we find gaps that the technology can close?
All right. I had a really good question, but instead, I kind of like when I give you two options and you're going to make up a new one anyway. So here's what we're going to do. So one of the ones that we've, something that we started doing in some of our recent episodes is, you, Jeremy, get to ask me and Rebecca a question that you'd like to have answered that you'd think the audience would also think is relevant, but with you, it's probably just something you're interested in. So you can ask us the same question, or you can ask me and Rebecca different questions, or you can do whatever Jeremy Shore is going to do anyway. So you are now the host of Amp to 11. We are your guests. We flip the script. Go.
The thing that I'm thinking about more than anything right now is something we've discussed a couple times already in this conversation, and that's, how are you, how are the two of you supporting the human side of this evolution? What are you thinking about to make sure that we're not just preserving, you know, humanity in all of these technology infused and AI infused realms, but hopefully enhancing it and growing it?
This is stuff I think about all the time. I think about it in like kind of in three different levels, I guess. I think about how it can be useful for like people and the human part of, as soon as people see, oh, this can help me with this, now I have buy-in. It's addressing this pain point. And maybe I wasn't open to it before, but now I see directly how it can help me, and teaching kind of ethical and responsible use at that level. But then also to talking to organizations, you know, schools or districts or businesses or nonprofits, about how to do that properly and how to invest in people. And again, why to not get rid of people? There's just been announcements this past week of big companies who laid off a bunch of people in favor of AI, and now they have job postings up because they realized AI can't do all of the things they wanted it to, and they're trying to hire people back. So I like having those conversations with organizations. But I think a lot about the government and the governance levels. I do think, you know, we may disagree on this. I do think there's some work to be done in holding the big tech companies and organizations kind of accountable, or getting involved in terms of incentivizing businesses to not lay people off, you know, like making sure that there's money there to keep people working so we don't end up in that future where people aren't working. I do think there's a lot to be done in educating people so we can all put pressure on these governments or organizations or whatever it takes, these people who have, you know, insane amounts of power to control which direction this forks. But that's kind of a lot of what I talk about and think about right now, but on all those different levels.
And I know you're working in the ethics and biases space. Like when I'm sure this is probably a 7-hour conversation, not a 90-second one, but, you know, younger kids, when we're talking about, you know, elementary aged students, how are you thinking about those biases and teaching them about those in a way that a second grader can sort of understand and internalize?
It's so hard. On a personal level, I don't think that kids younger than like high school age should be using generative AI in its raw current state, like ChatGPT, for that exact reason. I think there need to be like human-led lessons and discussions about the fundamentals of discrimination and stereotypes and biases and how to spot those things before you're just like immersed in it. You don't know what's true. And the processes for discovering truth and identifying sources, I think those are foundational. And I just don't know that there's enough safeguards on raw AI to be meaningful. And I don't necessarily trust that the tech companies are doing a good job of addressing some of those issues for, you know, even implementing it into schools and younger grades. That's just a personal feeling, but it is something that, and I don't even know if I'm well qualified to talk about some of that stuff. I just read a lot about how the discrimination and bias and the issues that led to those being in the AI and the issues that it's causing. And like you, I can see a future where that gets really, really bad really quick. I live in an area that, you know, was inhabited for centuries by Indigenous people here in Canada, and they had a primarily oral culture and safeguarded their wisdom through knowledge keepers and wisdom keepers orally. And so you already know that if you ask an AI model about anything to do with their history, it will hallucinate and reinvent history and make that up for people. And that's a primary concern, you know, especially in the education system and for those cultures. And so I just think that we need to lay groundwork young, you know, for digital literacy in general. And hopefully that's one of those things we don't rely on AI to help with too much from an early age.
Brett, do you also, like Rebecca, think that I'm an unfit parent for allowing my 3-year-old and middle schooler to...
No, you're supervising them. You're supervising them. You're fine.
You know, you're both saying something similar. You know, Jeremy, you know, I've been like to your neck of the woods in Ohio. And like Rebecca, I've met you and obviously your husband. Like, you all have so many skills that I'm so impressed by. And one thing that I really love about AI is it really lets you tap into a creativity that I didn't have before, right? Like, I can't draw something really amazing for my 2 kids, but now my imagination has no bounds and they see that. And then they get excited by that. Whereas like, I can't sit down with my son and like, you know, teach him piano, but I can like create really cool things around that that make him more excited to play the piano. So I think that's what I love. It gives me this, honestly, I feel like it's a superpower, a magic trick. Like, I really believe that. And it lets me make other people feel excited about life and allows me to connect in a way I just couldn't until AI. So, you know, an example, we went away for Mother's Day with a group of neighbors. And at night, you know, it's all, let's say everyone's between the age of like 4 and 7. And I go to the lobby, I get all these crayons and markers and pencils. And I'm like, you know, everyone just start drawing. And then they start getting a little antsy. And I was like, let me try something. I took a picture of it. I was like, let's make it like a Van Gogh picture. And when I tell you, there's like 7 kids, they've all been drawing the whole night. They've been like, fine. When I did that, their faces and eyeballs, it like could have been a movie, just lit up. And they were like, that is so beautiful to each other. They're complimenting each other. They're excited. And they're like, can you do mine next? And I'm like, tell you what, we can even turn these into Mother's Day cards if everybody tonight goes to sleep. They're like, okay, great, we'll do it. Like, that magic is something where I'm never going to take that for granted because it creates these very special moments that I couldn't otherwise do. So like all those years of being a teacher, like same as you, Jeremy, as you're mentioning, like this just adds a whole nother dynamic to my relationship with people. But I actually try to work really hard to remove the tech part from the magic. Like, they're not on my phone. I take one picture, I put it away, and I, you know, I prompt it, and I'm like, keep drawing. I'll show you when it's done. Or like you're doing with the conversation. My son refuses to believe that there's not 50 states. I was like, man, I'm a history teacher. Like, there's 50 states, man. And he's like, well, go ask Siri. I'm like, no. Yeah, I was a history teacher. We haven't had a new state. And finally, like, a teenager came to our house. And I'm like, all right, this kid's an adult. He's taking the AP US history exam. How many states are there? He's like, I believe 50. I'm like, no, don't sugarcoat it. There's 50. So I love the dynamic that AI has brought into my, like, relationship with my students, like, the kids I'm helping in the neighborhood, my friends, my children's friends, my children, my relationship. I also, though, like you all said, it's kind of like so dangerous to think like the novelty of it is exciting to me. And like, I can't not separate that from all the ethical considerations, but I'm trying to like, again, utilize it the best way possible, the tools that I have in front of me. So that's how I've been really trying to embrace the human element of it. It really brings out a new dynamic in relationships, especially, you know, like multilingualism. There, obviously, Google Translate was like, a magic trick at one point in my life. But like now, when I travel abroad or when my wife's family wants to speak in Spanish, like I'm not even worried. I don't get anxiety. I'm like, I got this. Like, I can communicate with you and we're going to laugh and we're going to enjoy our time together in a way we never could have based on your level of fluency in English and my level of fluency in Spanish. So like, I see it always as a bridge and it's bringing more joy to people. But I'm not also ignorant of all the other parts. It's just, I'm trying to embrace the really good parts that I wouldn't have had otherwise.
I love that. So with both of you, it's a focus on and kind of the democratization of content and tool creation, but within, you know, sort of bounds and frameworks where it's still that human interaction that's kind of structuring that creation and just the tools around it. I love everything about it. You know, we've talked about hackathons for years. We've done hackathons for years, and I've always found them to be kind of a hollow promise because either kids come with all of the skills they need and they don't need to be there, or they don't and they don't actually make anything. But with these tools, kids can come in and leave 4 hours later actually solving a problem in their community, but only when it's a situation where adults or trusted people are, you know, sort of guiding them through the process of seeking, finding, and creating those solutions. And that's the power. We could have really, really incredible school and education experiences in pretty short order here.
I think you touched on something really important. And I think we talk a lot, because this is an EdFocus podcast, on getting kids smart about using AI. But I really think we need to invest in getting the adults in those kids' life smart about using it strategically. Obviously, your guys' kids are lucky enough to have parents who understand the technology and know how to use it strategically. But there's just this whole generation that kind of missed digital literacy in general because the internet wasn't there when they were in school. And now they're even farther behind and they don't know how it works. So I think the goal is every kid has in their life an adult who can guide them to use this technology responsibly, right? A human in the loop, an adult in the loop in their life, that would be the dream for sure.
One thing that, you know, Jeremy, like to your point, like you said, I think you said before, like the idea that this can like really like push forward, amplify like what you're doing already working. Like you were talking about teachers who have like a curriculum or a unit they love. So something that really irks me, like truly, is when my children don't show like respect and politeness, even if it's like minimal. And I'm very like, and I tell them all the time, the same way I'm acting with you is how I acted for 16 years with my students. Like, it's not because you're disrespecting me. It's because, like, you know, what your habits become, like, who you are. So I'm a very big believer in, like, I don't care how small the request is. Like, you need to always say please and thank you because you're going to forget to do it. And one day that could have a big impact on your life. And so with AI tools, I mean, you know, you can literally be like, hey, Siri, play the Beatles. And it just sounds sometimes so weird for a four-year-old to say that. Like, hey, Siri, do this thing for me. And I'm like, this is magical, the fact that you have this. So I actually made a GPT that's called, like, I don't know, Manners Matter or something like that. And it literally, if I put that one on, it will say back, like, I'd love to play the Beatles. What's a magic word that you think would make me start the song? You know, something like that. I can't do a Siri, but I can do this GPT thing when they want to ask, like, how many states are there? Like, it makes you have to say, could you please tell me how many states there are in the United States? So even that is a way to, like, if you're warm and demanding, how can you have technology help you build those? And even with students, if you know there's like something they're never gonna, like, what is the PBIS thing or the incentive that's gonna like make them do anything? Same thing. That's another way to change behavior. And it's not coming from you, but it's like shape the path for them and have them practice things. Like, they all say they want jobs. Great. If you can't talk to an AI tool politely, how are you gonna do that interview, man? You know, stuff like that.
I say please and thank you also, not because I'm trying to practice my politeness, but because just in case Claude achieves sentience, I want him to like me.
Yeah, I want my four-year-old to sleep, Jeremy, so I don't tell her yet, like, one day this is actually going to control everything, and I want them to, but yes, we're on the same page. That's the real why, but I don't tell my four-year-old that, who gets nightmares over way, way less scary things than that. But yes. All right, Jeremy, you did a great job on that. We have one last question for you, and then we're going to call it. We're going to take a wrap here. Take as much time as you need or as little time as you need on this, and take a second if you need to, you know, think through it. But essentially, you know, AMP to 11, we always talk about this idea that, like, you need to have the right squad to pull off the impossible, which is transform education, make it meaningful, all the things you've been sharing today. So in Ocean's 11, you know, George Clooney puts together the perfect crew to pull off the impossible heist. If we're going to pull that off in public ed, society, who are some members of your Ocean's 11 squad? Who are they? What are they doing that's amazing? This is really your chance. Just give flowers and praise to great people doing great work out there in the space. Take your time. It's all yours.
All right. Well, first of all, before I do that, Brett, I have to hit this button on my soundboard really quick. You ready?
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
I had to mention that. You know, Brett, I suspect that most people that you talk to are talking about sort of people in the, you know, in the AI education sphere kind of directly. So I'm going to go a tiny bit rogue and maybe I'll come up with a third, but I can think of two people that I go to a lot because they're outside of that sphere. The million people, probably I'd say the same people that other people have said, right? Because there's a lot of, you know, there are a handful of voices that are really big in our world. So number one, for sort of a weird reason, is my friend Michael is the executive director of the Grant Imahara STEAM Foundation. Really, really brilliant guy. Video game designer by trade. Retired at, you know, like 25 or something. I'm making all, Michael, if you're listening to this, all of these numbers are wrong. And now works for the STEAM Foundation as their executive director, just out of the goodness of his heart, because he's a great person. Where I'm very bullish on both the promise and the peril of AI, he's a little more bearish. And so when I say these really bombastic things and he's around, he's always like, where's the data? Like, let's dig into this. Why do you actually think this? Have you worked with GPT or, you know, OpenAI's APIs and seen kind of how dumb this technology is if you're talking directly to the APIs and all of these things? So he pushes back and causes me to think more deeply about what I'm saying, and also to think of new ways that technologies are coming around. He's working. I wish I could tell you about it on recording. I can't. He's working on a new video game right now that uses large language models, and it is incredibly cool. So he's one. Another is, I was one of those weird kind of path people. So at one point, trying to differentiate myself in schools, I decided to grab an MBA real quick. And my strategy professor is now the dean of business at a university. And he does two things that I think are really interesting, especially in a business college. The first is he's the first business dean I've ever met that is very pro liberal arts education. He's a big believer. A lot of business deans who I've known through the years just want more accounting classes. And he's a big believer that if you really want to be a leader, you need to take some poetry and some biology and all of these things and have these different viewpoints. But he's expanded that to a situation where in order to graduate with an undergraduate business degree in his university, you're going to have to complete what they call a tech core, and you have to take two or three courses in computer science and programming. You're going to have to take a couple of courses in AI, or you already do have to take these courses, because it's his belief that CEOs and leaders of companies usually have a pretty strong grasp of the technologies and the knowledge in every area of their company, at least an understanding, except for technology. When it comes to, you know, the programming team, when it comes to the team working on custom AI, they sort of fall short. While his work doesn't directly impact me, what it causes me to do is to constantly go back to that question of what is it that everybody does need to know about these technologies? Rebecca's point, what do parents need to know? What do parents who have no interest in AI, work in a career where AI is not impacting it and they're going to retire before it does, but there are still things that they need to know, what is it? And I really think that sort of thinking about this kind of fundamental understanding of the world around us, that's kind of the level in my mind of CS and AI that every single person needs. We all need to understand from a biases perspective, from an accuracy perspective, from a sourcing perspective, from a job and school interruption or disruption perspective. We have to understand technologies just at that level. I don't need every single student to understand the fundamental architecture behind large language models or AGI. I don't need them to understand that at a technical level. I just need them to understand how it can and will impact their life moving forward and how they can harness the power instead of being sort of harnessed by it.
Good. You really went deep on a couple of key people in your life. That was really cool.
This is one question I wish I had read ahead of time, because I could have come up with some others.
Well, you know, Jeremy, that's the catch-22 of off-the-cuffness. But two that you, the ones you did highlight, you got to go really deep on, and I'm sure when they hear this, they're going to be very very touched and inspired by the work they've done, that it mattered to you.
I have one random question to finish this off. It's like my favorite question we usually ask. You've heard of 11 Labs. It's like one of my favorite AI tools. The 11 Labs reader app is my favorite. Burt Reynolds reads me all of the research papers that I read. I only hear about machine learning in Burt's voice. But if you could have any voice voicing all of your audio stuff, I know that you're using Sesame and that probably has a specific voice. Whose voice would you want to read you everything?
I do have an answer for this. We're a Sonos household, like to kind of a ridiculous degree. There's not a room in the house that doesn't have a Sonos device, including like three zones outside. And Sonos has their own voice assistant, which is great because it's purpose-built for music. So, you know, all of the other voice assistants get music things wrong all of the time because they're doing a million things. This only does music, so it is incredibly good at music. But the voice is Giancarlo Esposito, Gus Fring from Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. And he has the like smoothest, sexiest voice you've ever heard. And it sounds so good coming out of like the Sonos in the house when we request something that I'd take Giancarlo Esposito all day long, every day on every single voice that I have.
I feel like we need to get like an audio clip of that and put it in here, and also get an audio clip of your Sesame voices that are so good and add them in for a demo, because I'm so
Miles
curious now.
Miles on Sesame is going to blow your mind. It really is going to blow.
That's literally where I'm going right when we're done here. I'm so excited.
So there's Maya and there's Miles. Maya's really good too. I think the reason Miles is so good is that Maya is created like 11 Labs. You know, it is a completely fabricated voice. Miles was a voice print of one of the engineers. So it's still the underlying technology that allows the incredibly smooth transition and there's like no sound gaps or pause gaps, any of those things. But I think it's because, you know, back to that humanistic thing, I think it's because it is a real voice. And that's a big part of why it sounds so great.
Maybe that's why I like my Burt Reynolds, because I'm sure they had a lot of clips of his real voice that they used to train him. So interesting. Thank you so much for being here. I learned a lot from you, Jeremy. And yeah, it's been great to get to know you. I can't wait to follow you on LinkedIn. Hopefully people follow you here. Is there anywhere else that people can find you online or should be following you, or a website they should head to?
I can jeremyshore.com, tiesteach.com, .org, tiesteach.org, stemecosystems.org, but jeremyshore.com take you to all of those. I miss the days when I had like 100,000 Twitter followers, but deleted that account a while back. So LinkedIn and those other ones, and we'll go from there. But really, I'm a hanging out in real life person. You'll see if you go to my LinkedIn, one of my absolute favorite things. So, you know, I've got the little Calendly scheduling link on there, right? That everybody has these days. But if you go to that, one of the things in there is just Coffee with Jeremy. And Coffee with Jeremy is my favorite thing of the entire week. You're not allowed to talk about like work or projects or anything along those lines. You bring coffee, we hang out, we talk about what we're into, what we're excited about, you know, in both directions. Never feel guilty doing it, because it's the most refreshing part of my week that I spend, you know, in this basement. So
a Coffee with Jeremy, as I'm sure our listeners have learned, can go a lot of different ways, but it's always a good time. And you're always going to leave learning something. So thank you, Jeremy, so much for joining us. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the M211 podcast. Have a wonderful day, and keep staying curious and keep bringing innovation to the communities you serve. Take care.